Saddam, of course, had started all this 12 years ago when he'd gone down to Kuwait. He had gone out, basically taking his followers, the Saddamites, out into the desert there. And, of course, they crossed a line in the sand. Now, let's talk about the line. This line was given to them free of charge, a perfectly good line. Was drawn there in 1922 by the British High Commissioner. I don't know what he was high on at that time, but he drew that line. And Saddam crossed over it. Why? Because he wanted to dominate the entire Arab world. Well, that's our job. So we had to go in there and protect the peoples of the the Persian Gulf. And this is a very, very mysterious region, not to say inscrutable. That's further east, of course. But it is mysterious, and there are many things that even I don't understand, even with all my briefings, such as how did our oil get under Kuwait? No one could ever explain that to me. But then he was at it again with the weapons of mass destruction and so forth. You may have heard that some of that information was not information. Well, listen, I'm not really here to give you information so much as I'm here to get you in formation, you know. But the thing is that, well, we might as well just talk about it at this point. It's the Niger Gate thing. This has to do with Saddam buying or attempting to buy a yellow kick uranium from Niger. Some of you know it as Niger Gate because you listen to the BBC, and, well, they're French, you know. But, of course, that Niger Gate thing never happened, you know, the way it was reported. Although, interestingly enough, we got that intelligence from Britain, and over in Britain, actually, it still happened. Yeah, it's very interesting, but former ambassador went over there, determined that it didn't happen, and then somebody who may or may not have been married to him may or may not have worked for the CIA, and that may have been exposed by somebody associated with the office of President Bush there. So we're going to commission a study on this to get on top of it, not to cover it up, but to get to the bottom of it so we can get out in front of it and get it behind us, basically. Anyhow, we decided that we had to go take care of Saddam, and the French didn't understand that because they said, well, you're supposed to be looking for Osama. Why are you going after Saddam? Well, they didn't have the intelligence reports that we have and that we had received at that time, which indicated that Osama actually is hiding. Now, inquiring minds want to know where. Small details. Well, most likely he had left already by that time Afghanistan in order to pass through the Sudan to get to Pharmaceutistan. And if you go that route, you can get up through Syria to Illyria and on to Iraq. Well, that is why we had to look for him in every country that ends in A, An, or Ak. Now, the French didn't know this. And as a result, you didn't know how to boycott the French. And that's hard, because if you boycott the wines, you might accidentally boycott California, and we need to do that later on purpose. Although we now have the Austro-Hungarian Empire in place there, so that's probably off in a distant future. But however, here it is. If you don't, next time it comes around that we have to boycott the French, you just don't buy anything that ends in an, en, or e, and you're fine. We explained to these people, the Germans too, we explained to these people, you're either with us, or you're with the UN. It's that simple. Now, the old Europe was not with us. Luckily, we had already developed New Europe, and they were with us, and we had support from Slovenia, Estonia, Micronesia. Basically, all of the countries ending in EA were with us. The entire nation of Berlusconi supported us. You know, Turkey was with us. Well, not the people, but in general. And so they asked me to go over there, and I went with the coalition of the willing to be bought. And, of course, people said, what is it about? You're just going over there for the oil. It's not about the oil. If it was about oil, we would just bomb Texas. No, it's not. It's clearly not about the oil. It's about gasoline. This is the Terrorist International, which you know as the Axis of Evil. Now, the Axis of Evil, don't confuse that with the Evil of Access. That's an Enron thing, and that's... That is a private business scandal having nothing to do with the government aside from the president, vice president, trade advisor, top political advisor. Also, Axis of Evil, not to be confused with the SUV problem, the Axles of Evil, totally different desk that they're on.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Robert Poland talking about his book, Back to Full Employment.
Okay, so now, what's the number? You know, what do I call full employment? It doesn't have to be zero unemployment, because there are always going to be people between jobs that we call frictional unemployment. Somewhere in the range, I think, of 3.5% unemployment, truly 3.5%, not just the narrow number, but true 3.5, somewhere in the range of 3.5%, and everyone else is going to be between jobs. And the reason I say that is what we've seen, there has been, we were at, below 4% unemployment in 1998, briefly. And in the 1960s, we went 4 years at around 3.5%. And what happened? Workers did get raises. In 1997 and 98, raises, it was the only time, you can see the picture in the book, over this 30-year period, all of a sudden workers did get raises, especially workers in the lower 20% of the labor market got the fastest raises. So that's good. I see that as a good. Now, will it cause inflation? It might cause a little, but that's also good. That's not a problem. If the inflation rate goes up by, to 3-4%, but we're operating at a full employment economy, that's a positive. If inflation is caused by speculation in the oil markets, which we now have as a severe problem, that's bad. So we have to understand the source of inflation. But that's really my idea of where a practical full employment level should be.
During the 90s, I think during the Clinton years, productivity gains were way up.
Right.
So a worker could get more money, but he got more, so you could get more money, you produce more.
Yeah.
So that's why, I think one reason why inflation, you had the low unemployment and also low inflation, didn't lead to high inflation.
Yeah.
Productivity gains were astronomical, I think, during the 90s.
Well, the raises in the 90s, again, just looking at this little picture here, the raises in the 90s were very brief. And because on this low unemployment rate was very brief. Now, and you can ask, well, what happened? Well, actually, it was the result of the previous financial bubble, the so-called dot-com bubble, where there was a lot of investment in the economy, a lot of borrowing, a lot of investment, and the economy became turbocharged for a couple of years. What I'm trying to get at is thinking of ways that we can get to that level of activity that will create a lot of jobs without relying on a financial speculative bubble. And that's where I think investments in building the green economy can be very important.
Well, how much productivity, like unit per output, they measure that in the economy. And always that makes the economy more efficient. That way, worker can get more money without leading to inflation.
That's right. That's exactly it.
It's more efficient.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
In addition to all you've laid out, do we also need to shorten the work week?
Yes, over time, I think that's a desirable policy. But right now, I've heard, I know that's a suggestion, and I know in Germany that's been part of the way in which the unemployment rate has not been as severe as here. But I think that if we put a lot of stress on that particular thing, then that is going to be taken to mean, okay, we don't have the capacity to create jobs. So then here's the number of jobs. Let's just chop up the hours more, and people are going to have less time, and they're going to make less. So right now, I don't see that as a really good solution.
I'm wondering if you could talk in specifics about policies around the green economy. What will we be asking the government? Is it mostly the government or private investment?
Well, I think
also?
It's both. I think it's both, because a big part of my thinking on the green economy is about efficiency. It's not just about solar power, wind power. Because, for example, buildings are the biggest source of energy consumption in the society. And our buildings operate at very low levels of efficiency. And the technology to raise efficiency is not fancy. Retrofitting buildings is things that can be done with on-the-shelf technologies. We don't have to think about, like with solar, a lot of progress, which of course I favor, but in terms of investing in building efficiency, all the technology is there, and the average investment in a retrofit pays for itself in 3 years, because you reduce your energy bill. So in a way, you don't really need the government to subsidize that. You just need to organize the financing so people don't have to put up all the money and put up all the risk, and the return comes back. So that's one big part of the overall picture. Banks could do that, yes. And well, the other thing is we should be retrofitting each and every government public buildings. I mean, that's good for the taxpayers. And in fact, there's a law on the books that passed in 2007, mark the year, because George Bush was president, and he signed the bill. And it said that, if I can get it exact, 75% of all the public buildings are mandated to be retrofitted by 2015 to achieve, I think it's 35% efficiency savings. It's a law. I don't know enough about the ins and outs of Washington to know when you pass a law, don't you have to enact, do something. So it's not happening. It is a law. So that would be very important, again, and it would be a benefit. Aside from the environmental benefit, it'd be a benefit to taxpayers because we would be paying 30% less for energy for all the government buildings. And it would set off the market, right? It would spill into the private market. People would think about it more.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
In terms of renewables, another thing people don't know, this again, government statistics, Energy Department. The U.S. Energy Department says that by 2017, wind power to generate a kilowatt of wind power is going to be at parity with coal and is going to be cheaper than nuclear power. This is not me. This is the Energy Department. Now, solar is more expensive, but solar has also been coming down very dramatically. So if not by 2017, some people think it will be, but within a decade, solar power will be at parity. The only source of energy at which renewables will not be at cost parity is fracking of natural gas. So this is this technology, fracking, that, yes, it does pull out natural gas from shale rock very cheaply, but it is an environmental disaster. So if we're looking at, a cheap energy future, we can do just fine with investments in efficiency and renewable if you put aside the fracking. So that's really, I think, going to be a big struggle in the future. And I know that the Obama administration is saying they are for investing in the green economy, but they're also, the phrase is, we're for all of the above, including especially cheap natural gas through fracking, and that we have to oppose that. There's no way I've got another book, maybe you'll let me come back on this stuff. Let me just summarize the result. There is no way you come close to meeting the emission reduction targets, the greenhouse gas emission targets, if we do anything like maintaining our existing level of consumption of coal, oil, and natural gas. No way you come close. So if you take the climate scientists at all seriously, which I do, basically we have to cut consumption of all three, coal, oil, and natural gas, by 50%, roughly 50, 40% within 20 years. So how can we build up this whole big fracking industry? Forget about the other the fact that it's contaminating water and it's creating volcanoes. Let's just put those aside. Just on the climate effects, you just can't do it. So therefore, the green economy is an imperative, an environmental imperative. It also so happens it's good for jobs. Yeah. Yeah.
I have to agree with you on energy savings. I work for a nonprofit that builds and rehabs affordable housing, and there's tremendous gains that can be made by going in and retrofitting buildings, insulating them, air sealing them, and it tends to be able to employ people at a semi-skilled level and people in the city centers that. But you may find it does need some subsidy, I think, for some of the older housing.
You have to get it started. It's very frustrating. Fred and I are in this profession, the economists, that somebody 200 years ago dubbed it the dismal science. because it's always like naysaying, saying, you know, nothing good is going to come. So the engineering evidence on the benefits of energy efficiency are massive. Again, I have this book coming out, but one of the things I did for this other book was a lot of what I just read, this study by the National Academy of Sciences called Real Prospects for Energy Efficiency. Again, this is not the heterodox economists talking. This is the National Academy of Sciences just culling together all the best engineering research. And basically what I told you about the benefits of efficiency are all in this National Academy of Sciences. On the other hand, you have the economists. Now here's the orthodox economists saying, no, no, that's engineering. The engineers don't know, you know, how economics really works. And the main argument from the orthodox economists is that you know, people don't want to do this. There is risk. Yeah, there's risk. There is hassle. It's time. You know, if you have a commercial building, you know, you've got to let these people in. They've got to do their thing. Who knows? They could be thieves. So there, and therefore, there is an article in one of the leading academic journals in economics which saying there's no benefits. There's no benefits to energy. Forget what all the engineering evidence says. When you take account of these other things, there's no benefits. Now, my response is, if there are such big, the engineering evidence, the scientific evidence is there, then our job is to think of ways to overcome whatever problems there are in terms of financing, in terms of hassle, in terms of building up the market. That seems to me to be the right economic answer. And so the things like what you're doing in your community, as that spreads, people will accept the idea, yeah, we should retrofit our building. Just like what will be happening is that cars are going to be getting twice as efficient over the next 15 years. And they're going to be a little more expensive, but people are just going to get used to it. And then they're going to see, yeah, you're going to pay, you know, $3,000 more, but then you're going to get, you know, $1,200 a year in savings. So it's going to pay for itself in 2.5 years.
On your earlier thing about the difference between the productivity gains and the wage levels, how are we selling the output? Where is it going? I mean, if you're not, you know, the upper classes can't be consuming half of the economic output. And no. So does that mean that we're condemned to debt to clear all this?
And household debt up until the 2008 crisis basically doubled as a share of household income. From 1980s, it was about 50% of household income. By 2008, it's over 100%. So people were living beyond their means. I mean, part of the way they did that was we had, you know, the housing bubble. So house prices were going up. So that meant people were more wealthy on paper. They borrowed, you know, second mortgages, and that enabled them to sustain a living standard that was in excess of their income. Another way, of course, people took more than one job. So I'm talking about the average wage for one job. So you double up, you have two jobs, even if they're low-paying jobs. So that was also started to become customary. And then the other part of it is, yeah, that the level of consumption, of course the wealthy can't, there's only so much they can buy, but consumption by the rich, became much more of a focus. And, yeah, the rich became, you know, being rich didn't just mean you had a nicer house and a nicer car. It meant you had two houses, meant you had a private plane. And all of those things actually do add up to some significant level of consumption.
How much should the government subsidize companies? Like, I'm thinking of the solar companies. I'm thinking of Solyndra. Is that when?
Glad you asked me about Solyndra. Okay, because there's a big myth. I was in this email exchange with somebody who's a very, very good journalist. You probably have some of her books. I won't mention her name. But she just wrote me about this yesterday, and I said, I can't believe you've bought this stuff. Okay, so Fred mentioned that I was consulting on the Energy Department. I was consulting on, among other things, the project at which Solyndra got its subsidy. So here's the story. The program was to give out loan guarantees to big companies that were investing in renewable energy. So there was 24 companies that got, they didn't get loans from the government. They got loan guarantees, meaning that they got private loans that they had to pay back. Only if they failed to pay back, then the government was on the hook. Okay, so there are 24 companies. Three of them have defaulted, Solyndra being the biggest. Okay, so the total amount of loan guarantees was $16 billion. Of the three companies, add up the three companies, the amount that the government was on the hook for out of $16 billion was $600 million. Okay. So it's about 6%. Now, on top of that, when these companies defaulted, Solyndra, you know, they do have assets, you know, and the government takes all their assets. And then they can sell them off. They have buildings, they have machines, they have land. So basically, the government was on the hook for $300 million. So let's say it was a $300 million program that led to $16 billion in new investments in the green economy. This is a successful program. It's when I was doing the main thing I was doing with the Energy Department was they showed me this long list of the specific projects under the stimulus, and they said, if we spend this amount of money, how many jobs are we going to get out of spending this amount of money? And not surprisingly, the best way to spend the money was through these loan guarantees, because most of the time the loans don't default. So, you know, basically the government spent $300 million and got $16 billion worth of new jobs. This is a really good program. So, yes, there's going to be failures. Of course, that's exactly why you have a loan guarantee, because there's some risk. Even with some risk, 90% of the time, the program succeeded.
Cost-benefit analysis, like you said, you're a consultant. You went on, how do they determine who gets a loan? Do they analyze the financial statements?
Yeah, I will say this. I think, you know, this was a big program. It was a new program. There's more commitment on this green investment program than actually has ever been done in U.S. history. And then I was sitting there talking to these people doing it. And part of the problem was, you know, it hadn't been done before. So, of course there are going to be mistakes. And of course it's difficult to scale up. You know, under Bush, it was like $1 billion. So the stimulus was $90 billion. So you go from $1 billion to $90 billion. They're naturally going to be startup difficulties. For the most part, though, the programs were succeeding, and including this one. So it's gotten a terrible press. I tell this story in this new book that made Now, the trouble is, I hope this book is readable. The other one is not. I've got to rewrite it to make it readable. But I tell this story, and I'm dying to put it out, but I can't. I've got to wait till, you know, my publisher wouldn't like it very much if I started, you know, giving all the details before the book comes out. But no, Solyndra was a successful. Solyndra itself failed. The program under which Solyndra got its loan guarantee has been a success. Yeah.
I just wanted to follow up on that, because it seems like some of those companies might have been willing to make the investment in the absence of the support from the government.
That's true.
So it seems like the total $16 billion, should that be scaled back? What fraction of that do you think would have happened without intervention, and what more could have been done if more money was on the table for companies to invest?
I don't know. That's a very good question. Yeah, that is one of the criticisms. That is, well, the banks made the loan with the loan guarantee. Maybe they would have made a loan without a loan guarantee. And, you know, you do have to try to judge that. But for the most part, I think this is a good way for the government to leverage its financial capacity. It's a lot less expensive than directly spending. I should mention, in terms of renewable energy, the biggest level of activity in the U.S. economy today, or maybe in the world today, in terms of renewable energy, I have to say, is the U.S. military. The U.S. military has committed, and I think they're serious, to having, by 2025, 25% of all their energy coming from renewable sources. And they are doing some fairly innovative things. And it's not all government spending. What they're doing is also saying, okay, private firms, you build up the solar, you build up the wind, and then we'll buy it from you, and we'll have a long-term contract, and we'll buy from you. And that is going to, I think, become very significant. You know, if we look at where innovation has taken place, technological innovation in this country since its founding, a lot of it has been tied, for better or for worse, in the military. And the one example that I would mention that is quite pertinent for the moment is the internet. The internet came entirely out of the U.S. military investment. It was subsidized in a major way for 35 years. So when Bill Gates says, hey, the internet came from private initiative, that's just false. The technology was developed by the U.S. government, subsidized massively by U.S. taxpayers, and then handed over to the private sector. And that's something like that. It obviously doesn't have to happen through the U.S. military, but something like that should be happening. And so this Solyndra case in the program is a smaller example of it's a very positive program. Once solar power and wind power are at cost parity, then they won't need big subsidies anymore. They'll need, again, we need to build out the market. People have to get used to it. We hear a lot about solar power. Do you know how the proportion of overall energy in this country that's supplied by solar power? Take a guess.
Like 2%.
How about like 0.25%? I mean, it's minuscule.
Up next, Huey Long. Huey Long, nicknamed Kingfish, was an American politician who served as the 40th governor of Louisiana from 1928 to 1932 and as a member of the United States Senate from 1932 until his assassination in 1935.
How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business.
Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat, and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Where's that stuff back on this table here that you took away from here that you don't need? Leave something else for the American people to consume.
And now for something completely different.